Hello, everybody. I'm Radio Johnny, and you are listening to Recovery Radio on KRFP 90.3 FM in Moscow, Pullman. Recovery Radio is recorded live at the Latah Recovery Center, located at 531 South Main Street in Moscow. You can contact the LRC by phone at 208-883-1045 or by email at latahrecoverycenter@gmail.com. You can find them on the web at latahrecoverycenter.org and on Facebook. Recovery Radio's purpose is to share with our community how addiction and behavioral health disorders affect us all and how we deal with them. We also share the personal stories of people in and around recovery, highlighting their experience, insight, and hope for continued recovery. And a special announcement, there will be a mental health walk sponsored by Disability Action Center, the Latah Alliance on Mental Illness, and Wellness Recovery Action Plan. And that will be a week from today, May 11th, starting at the Palouse Mall. Check in at 10:30 and walk starts at 11. And to get more information on this, contact LAMI at lami.advocacy@gmail.com. And also be a presentation at Friendship Square at noon. So if you can't walk, definitely make it to the presentation. And here's the May calendar in lightning fashion. Harm reduction, safe syringe exchange and supplies, weekdays by appointment. Recovery coaching, peer support, that's weekdays by appointment. Vandal recovery at the center on the U of I campus, Wednesdays and Thursdays from 1 p.m. to 4:30. Fridays from 2 p.m. to 4:30. Alcoholics Anonymous meets every day at noon. Narcotics Anonymous meets every day at 7 p.m. Sexaholics Anonymous is Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday at 8:30 p.m., Saturday at 9 a.m. The AA Monday Men's Meeting is Mondays at 5:30 p.m. The Reentry Support Group with Miranda meets Mondays at 6:30 p.m. AA Women's Meeting live at St. Mark's Episcopal and available on Zoom is Mondays at 7:30. Recovery Peer Volunteer Meeting is the last Monday of the month at 6 p.m. Yoga with Twasi is Tuesdays at 1:30. The Board of Directors Meeting is the second Tuesday of every month at 3:45, and the public is invited. The Vandal All Recovery Meeting at the Center on campus is Tuesdays at 6 p.m. The Events Committee meets Wednesdays at 2. New Volunteer Orientation is Wednesdays at 3. Overeaters Anonymous meets Wednesdays at 5:30. North Idaho AIDS Coalition Free AIDS and Hepatitis C Testing. That will be on Thursday, May 25th from noon till 2 p.m. Adult Children of Alcoholics meets Thursdays from 2:30 till 4. Movie and Game Night is Thursdays from 5 till 8. Oscar Mike Vets Coffee and Conversation is Thursdays at 5:30. Open Office Community Day, come on in, see what we do here, is Fridays during our open hours from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. The Intern Meeting is Fridays at 2. Overeaters Anonymous Step Meeting is Fridays from 5:45 to 6:45. Al-Anon Live and on Zoom is Fridays at 8. And this month's LRC social events will be going to the Renaissance Fair, and we'll meet at the Arch by the 3rd Street Park, and that's Saturday, May 6th at noon. Finally, Alcoholics Anonymous Sunday Morning Group is at the center on campus, and that's Sundays at 9:30 a.m. And you can access all these Zoom meetings by going to our calendar on the website, latahrecoverycenter.org. Click on the group name and follow the instructions from there. If you have any problems, give us a call, 208-883-1045, and we will help you get going on Zoom. And that's the calendar of events for the Latah Recovery Center. And again, I am Radio Johnny, and in the conference room / studio with me today is Casey McDevitt, who is what is your exact title here? Just volunteer or?
Yeah, I'm a volunteer and I sit on the board of directors.
Right. And you're on the board now. That's right. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Almost forgot about it. That's not the only thing you do. You volunteer here how many nights a week?
Evenings? Just one.
Just one on Monday nights. And in your day job, what is your official title for your day job?
My official title is behavioral health manager.
Okay. Behavioral health manager. Sounds good. Casey, you know, I invited you here today to talk about trauma and how trauma relates to recovery and, you know, just behavioral health in general. And I think it would be a great place to start is just defining what trauma is. And then we'll go into, you know, how trauma relates to other things. But what is trauma to begin with?
Trauma is, you know, anything that has happened in someone's life that has caused some sort of interaction in the brain that has resulted in like maladaptive like behaviors. You know, some people experience trauma and are able to work through that and heal from that, and it's fine. Other people, for whatever reason, develop post-traumatic stress disorder, which is closely related to addiction. You know, when we experience a trauma, our brains, one side of our brain, left side of our brain, is like the explicit memory, right? Like the actual event that happened.
Right.
And then there's implicit memory, which is the right side of the brain. And that's cataloging all of the things around the trauma, sights, sounds, smells, like anything that was related, right? So someone who develops PTSD or who doesn't adapt to that trauma, their brain is kind of stuck in this fight or flight mode. So an example I like to give people is, you know, let's say someone who is in combat and like war combat and experiences, you know, bombs or shootings or just these loud noises that cause problems. And then they come home. Some people adapt to being home, and some people have these reactions when they hear a car backfiring or fireworks going off, right? Like logically, they know that they're not in any danger. They're not in the middle of a war zone,
right?
But their brain is hearing those sounds, and it's related to the sounds they were hearing in combat, and it triggers that fight or flight.
Right, right. And so you end up with like panic attacks and
and
other things like that.
Yeah, so many things, and it's hard to like function day to day when that's what your brain is doing because of a trauma that has happened, because trauma impacts our brain, our bodies, like everything.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit. And I think it's another point we're talking about, that trauma is not always obvious to the sufferer.
Yes. Yeah, in the mental health world, we call it big T trauma, like big trauma and little trauma. So big trauma is going to be those very obvious traumas: combat, sexual assaults, car accident, natural disaster, like those big things that are obviously going to be traumatizing. But then there are also little things that can happen that are causing trauma, and you may not even know that you've been traumatized.
Right. For example, let me throw this at the wall and see if it sticks. As a young, you know, man growing up in the 50s and 60s, we basically were told, you stuff your feelings.
Mm.
And, you know, so if somebody dies that you're close to, a few tears are okay.
Sure.
But not a whole bunch. So, you know, in Minnesota, the famous thing is the, what do they call it? Funeral potatoes. You know, people bring stuff to the wake or the funeral afterwards. And for the longest time after, like, one of my grandparents passed away, who I was totally in love with, just the best grandma ever, I couldn't eat potatoes. And I couldn't understand why. It wasn't like they tasted bad. It's just, I just didn't want to eat them. And so, I mean, a death in a family might be considered a big T. I don't know. But even smaller things.
Yeah. Well, and that potatoes example is a perfect example of what I was talking about, where it's like your brain has cataloged this association with those potatoes. And so you developed this aversion to them without even really like connecting the dots. Another really common little T trauma is divorce. Mm-hmm. Like for me, like my parents divorced when I was 2.5. I don't even remember them being together.
Right.
But as an adult, I was able to recognize that being moved back and forth and just not having like a nuclear like household caused little T trauma.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. And my parents split up when I was adult. Well, I grew up in an alcoholic household, so plenty of trauma there to relate to. So now we understand there's a lot of different causes of trauma and different types of trauma. Mm-hmm. How do we go about, I guess the next step would be, if I was talking to you in your capacity as a counselor and mm-hmm. manager, how would we go about identifying these traumas? Now, there's a thing called, EMDR, which one of the former grad students that was here, we talked about it a little bit and did a little experimenting, but that's kind of a newer thing, mm-hmm. and there's talk one way and the other about it. But talk about it from identifying things from your perspective, what you are have been trained or is considered the acceptable form.
Sure. There are lots of ways to treat trauma. EMDR is probably the most common currently. Mm-hmm. But there's also a type of therapy called cognitive processing mm-hmm. that's used to treat trauma. And really, it depends on the person. You know, some people come in and they know they've been traumatized. They know they have trauma. They know a lot of their symptoms or their difficulty in functioning is related to that. Other people don't. And you kind of figure that out as you start moving through therapy, or we do. We kind of start to recognize like, oh, this might be some symptoms of, mm-hmm. of trauma that you've experienced. So the identification is the first part if they don't know. Right. If they do, you know, some people need to talk about it and like process through their trauma and like not reliving it, but kind of sharing the details and just kind of like working their way through it. But you don't even have to talk about it to heal from it, because PTSD in particular is a set of symptoms. So ultimately, it doesn't matter what happened. What matters is how it's impacting you. And so depending on the person, if they feel like they need to talk about it, that's what we do. We make timelines. We process through it. I sit with them while they talk through the things that have happened to them. In other cases, we just focus on the symptoms, because people may say, I've already talked a lot about it, or I don't want to talk about it. Or sometimes people don't even remember. Like they don't even have all the memories there.
Right.
And so then we just focus on the symptoms. Nightmares, intrusive thoughts, those kind of things. And so then we'll just focus specifically on the symptoms that are impacting their life. Right. And we focus on trying to heal some of that so that those symptoms dissipate a little bit.
Right. Right. But, well, I want to jump back a little bit. Identifying the traumas, helping people to identify those traumas. I'm having all kinds of these, you know, panic attacks or, my anxiety is constantly through the roof, and I don't know why. How do you go about uncovering those traumas that people like aren't even aware of?
Well, a lot of that is just kind of exploring maybe their past, like just getting to know like some of their life experiences. We also do a lot of charting, like, okay, this week between this time and the next time I see you, anytime you get really anxious, I want you to write what's happening. Where are you? Like, is something triggering that? And if you are able to spend some time focusing on those day to day, patterns start to emerge.
Right. Oh, that's, yeah. Not unlike some people do journaling.
Sure.
You know, for it just, I know there's a lot of self-help books out there that suggest journaling to do exactly that, to recognize patterns. It's like, I can't think of a specific example, but yeah, if you find yourself repeating some sort of behavior, and you might not even realize you're doing it. Or you have that, you burned your hands pulling something out of the oven, you know, when you were a kid, and every day on your way to work, you walk by a bakery, the smell of the oven hits you.
Yes, exactly.
Suddenly you go from bright, cheery to terrible shape.
Yeah.
So it could be as simple as recognizing that. What other techniques might people try?
I think those are probably the most common ones, the reprocessing through EMDR, talking about them, and then just, like I said, focusing on the symptoms and figuring, and it's our jobs to help people figure out what those patterns are and how we can determine that. And like I said, sometimes right. that's talking about past life experiences, mm-hmm. just so, because, you know, someone may tell me something that triggers me to be like, oh, that's trauma, where they didn't even recognize that.
Right.
And so then I can kind of bring that to their awareness and we can kind of start working from there.
Without naming names, of course, can you speak a little bit to the kind of traumas that you've helped people discover?
Yeah, I think the most common for me that I've dealt with is like abuse at home that wasn't recognized as abuse. So people coming in like, I can't figure out why I keep, you know, dating these kind of people and it's like always a train wreck, or like why I can't have healthy relationships. And then oftentimes you start talking and it's comes back to something that was happening at home, whether your parents were screaming at each other all the time, or like you got spanked a bunch, but I deserve that because I did something wrong, you know, like just like things that were happening at home that may not, you may not think of as abuse or like making this impact, but then later on it mm-hmm. impacts the decisions and the relationships you're in as an adult.
Right, right. Well, it's, you know, it's a common thing. I don't really know how true it is. Partially, I think, in my life, but, you know, they say men always want to marry their mother, right? Because that's where they get that, you know, reflection of what love is.
Yeah.
Or that's what they're taught through yep. observation, right? The really cool thing about that that I can relate to is I grew up in an alcoholic household, right? And so, yeah, there was a lot of screaming and yelling, and there was, you know, tons of dysfunction. And I went through a phase of doing cognitive therapy, talk therapy, mm-hmm. and just going through that process and being able to talk about it with somebody who was not judgmental and didn't constantly go, well, it wasn't your fault. It wasn't your fault. Because to a certain extent, how I deal with it is my fault, especially if I'm dealing with it poorly. And in my case, that was by, you know, self-medicating with alcohol and
yeah.
at times whatever else I could get my hands on, right?
Sure.
So it was really helpful to talk and explore that. And in that process, like you said, other things came up. The fact that, for example, I couldn't understand why when I went to college, I went for, I don't know, 2 years or 3 years at a junior college and netted about 20 units because I was not spending my time studying at school. Fortunately, it was a junior college in California that didn't, there was no tuition, so it was just books. So it wasn't like I was
sure.
throwing away the family fortune. But my whole thing was, growing up, I followed my brilliant sister through the higher education, through like high school, mm-hmm. especially. And she was such a smart overachiever, and God bless her, I love her. But when you follow something like that, there's this weird expectation that teachers have that like, oh, all the kids are like this. And on top of being just slightly dyslexic, and having a mind that just wandered anytime I got bored with what was going on.
Sure.
Through high school, and these teachers were like, we don't understand why you're not doing well. Your sister was so, I mean, I got mad and said some nasty words to a teacher, which cost me a couple of days off from school about, you know, I'm not my blankety blank sister. I guess the word got around because people dealt with me a little differently after that. But there's something that carrying forward, going into my workaday world, I tried to stay as far away as I could from following anybody
sure.
around. I worked in the computer manufacturing industry, which is very incestuous, you know, and if a company's laying off, you make 3 phone calls, you're working the next day. But I had to be careful. I was always very nervous to go, you know, say, have somebody recommend me who I knew was a super overachiever. It would have been a great thing. It would have been very helpful. But unbeknownst to me, I'm like, I don't want to try and follow that act because they're going to be disappointed. I'm not him.
Yeah. It's like a constant sense of failure.
Right. Right. So yeah, that's interesting stuff. Let's go and let you talk more. Now, what I was prattling on about there was, you know, the way I dealt with these traumas in my life was through alcohol, but that's not the only substance out there that people fall victim to. And we call it SUD, or substance use disorder. I often wonder why they don't call it abuse, because we don't just use, we abuse. But that's for another conversation. So
I think that, you know, recently language has been like a big conversation. Like, we don't want to use language that's going to have some sort of negative connotation.
Mm-hmm.
So like abuse, it's still there. We know that people, if they have a disorder, they're abusing substances. But now I think the language that is supposed to be like politically correct is misuse.
Right.
Substance misuse. Because I think the word abuse has like a strong connotation to it.
Yeah.
And, you know, historically there's been a lot of shame in addiction or people who are addicted. And so I think in recent years, they've tried to move away from shaming language.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Even though it's accurate.
Yes.
I mean, you know, I come from a program that we accept what we are. We were drunks. We were not alcohol. We didn't have substance, you know, use disorder. We were drunks. But I totally get it the other way. And it's really not all that important for the conversation we're having today anyway. But thanks for the side trip. I enjoy those little trips down the side lanes. But substance use as a coping mechanism.
Yes.
Bad idea?
Terrible. It's a terrible idea. You know, when I work with people who have trauma and substance use issues, which is more often than not, I mean, 99% of the time, when you've got somebody who is struggling with addiction, you're going to find trauma somewhere. Mm-hmm. I describe it to people like a rubber band ball. Like, it's like so intertwined, you can't fix one without the other, right? Like, you can't expect someone to get sober without dealing with the trauma, because that's what led to them using in the first place. And so if you aren't dealing with the thing that led you down that road, you're going to end up down that road again.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if you deal with the trauma, you're probably also going to be able to get sober. So you can't do one without the other. And so you're kind of like peeling off these little rubber bands that have, like, over however many years or however long you've been using, is like just become like bigger and bigger and bigger. And you're trying to like take apart like all of it.
Right. And, you know, my experience is before you can make any real progress working from the treating the trauma to affect the substances, for the people I hang out with, until they dry out, at least for a little while, you're not going to make much headway.
Yes.
That way.
That's
so how
generally
do you deal with that sort of...
That's generally my experience, too. There have been times where, like, the trauma or the mental health stuff was what we call superseding the substance use, or the other way, like what you're talking about, where the substance use is superseding the trauma. So that's kind of our job, to figure out what is most present and what we need to tackle first. Usually it's getting sober, even if it's just a little bit, just for a little bit of time, just to clear somebody's head, because you can't work on trauma if you're drunk or high,
right?
But the other thing that makes all of this complicated is that the substance use is a coping skill,
mm-hmm.
right? So you can't take away the only coping skill or the biggest coping skill people have been using without replacing it with someone else, something else.
Someone else. Ooh, Freudian slip.
But either or.
Right.
Or both.
Yeah.
So often that's where we start. We work on, like, how do you get sober right now, today? And what can we replace that with? Because when you get sober, your brain is doing all sorts of things. The, like, dopamine is trying to level out. You may be going through withdrawal symptoms.
Right.
Your emotions are big because you're not numb anymore. And so figuring out how to temporarily cope with that and then build these skills that you can use so that you aren't reverting back to that substance use when you start doing all of this hard, like, mental health work.
Right, exactly. And I follow that. I remember when I stopped drinking, you know, after I didn't even go to AA for, like, probably took me about a week to really get past all the nasty withdrawal symptoms. Mm-hmm. and just to be able to, like, sleep for 6 hours in a row. You know, there's all these things that happen when you stop, but I think the most significant work I did in the AA program, which was my program, didn't happen until I was maybe a year and a half without the substance, without the alcohol.
Sure.
Because it takes your brain that long to repair or mm-hmm. learn how to deal with things differently. I mean, there are chemical changes that happen in your brain, you know, your
Absolutely.
Synapses increase to absorb all the dopamine that's being flooded in there, and then you take that away and they're like, what things have to rewire. And that's in the early part of recovery, that's really the hardest part, because you have eliminated that coping skill in working through the steps in the program. That's the process. You're learning new coping skills.
That's right.
But that doesn't fit for everyone, though, does it?
No, but I would say for most people that is the case. Because even if your addiction wasn't born from trauma, you still eventually, at some point, were using it to self-medicate.
Right.
Whether it's staying well or it's caused relationship problems, depression, anxiety, whatever, all of the things addiction can elicit.
Right.
Like, you still, once that goes away, all of the damage you've done, all of the consequences, all of the time you've potentially thrown away, like, any of the consequences that come right. from using are there. And so when you take that away, again, you're very aware of all of the mess.
Right.
Right. And so either way, you're really starting with developing coping skills, whether that's a program like AA where you've got support and like-minded people, or just ways to, like, manage anger or anxiety or mm-hmm. sadness or whatever it is, like, that's where you're starting, is coping.
Right.
Because if you aren't able to cope, you're going to revert back to the thing that helps you cope.
Right, which is why relapse is so common.
Sure.
People come into Alcoholics Anonymous, for example, and they're moving right along. And we joke that it's not the death in the family that gets you to relapse. It's the broken shoestring when you're going to be 2 minutes late to work.
Yeah.
It can be a small thing, but it gets more complicated in my head right now, because we have, okay, you've eliminated the coping skill. And even if it wasn't trauma that put you into that situation you're in or were in, it's the trauma that you created for yourself yeah. that now you're actually realizing, where in the beginning, when you're on that pink cloud, just you're getting healthy, you're feeling better physically, the fog's clearing in your head, you can think better, you're relating to people better, relationships are improving. And then, oh yeah, but I still have to go to court over that whatever I did.
Yeah.
And now I'm looking at jail time, and yeah, guess what? You talk about as consequences, but also, I mean, that's going to be a trauma you're generating for yourself.
Yeah, the traumas we generate for ourselves in addiction, but also many people end up in traumatic situations when they're using, because you're not around any other people that are healthy, right? Like you're spending time around a lot of other people who are also using, and you're potentially being taken advantage of or being stolen from or getting in fights with people or whatever. Just like all the things, just that lifestyle is traumatic.
Right. And you know, I've heard it say that when you get sober or clean, but you, it's important to change your playmates and change your sandbox.
Mm-hmm. People, places, and things.
Yeah. Which are also, we talk about in AA, are things that you cannot control. So if you put yourself back in that scenario, it can be tough. I mean, even the state recognizes that with parolees. Yep. They tend to, a lot of the people that get paroled to North Idaho are people who are Boise, Ada County, Twin Falls, whatever. They're from that area. So if they have any kind of link to society, a relative or whatever that lives in the north, they'll send them up here.
Yeah.
So that they can hit the ground running, so to speak, and not be right back in the middle of that situation. And that's part of what our, along those lines, that's part of what, I know you're familiar with our jail reentry program, because you work with Miranda here quite a bit. You know, that's a similar thing. And speaking of that, have you ever had any conversations with Miranda on, I know Miranda does similar things to what you do as well in the counseling realm and whatnot. Has there been any talk about addressing trauma with these people that are transitioning? And let me back up a little bit just to explain to people that might not be aware. The Latah Recovery Center works with the county here to help people transition from incarceration back into society.
Right.
And to basically try to give them a leg up coming out rather than just what happens typically when people leave incarceration. It's like, here's your bag of stuff, see you in 6 months. And they go right back into
revolving
the lifestyle. The thing that they came to. So trauma, working with people in regards to trauma, is that something that we would like to do here? Or are you aware that that's being addressed in any way, shape, or form?
I think,
and
I mean,
I don't know is also a good answer.
Well, I know that the recovery center doesn't have a counselor. They do recovery coaching, right?
Right.
And so I do think, as far as I'm aware, if any like mental health stuff is showing up, or people are like the clients are expressing that they need help with those kind of things, the recovery coaches can link them up with a therapist or give them a referral to somewhere in town for them to get the kind of mental health treatment that they need.
Right. And I'm sorry if I made it sound like that, we're doing counseling and mental health here. I mean, it really is, our program is peer to peer.
Yes.
So people who have experience with addiction work with people who have addiction issues, people who have behavioral health problems that they learn to deal with, they work with other people. And I say counseling constantly, and it's counseling in a broad sense, but not counseling in a therapeutic type sense. So sorry people if I led you down the wrong path there. But we do connect people with professionals like yourself and organizations. Well, you actually work for a company out of Alaska.
I do.
That is crazy. But your husband, who I've met, he is a student right now, correct?
He's
U of I.
He's in law school, yeah.
Right. So that, and COVID allowed you to literally phone it in.
I mean, yeah.
And that's neat. That's fun that you're able to do that. So let's see, what haven't we stumbled through before I wander off into the darkness? Here's the thing. When we were talking about sober, get sober to address trauma and trauma to address sober. You say in your notes here, it's non-linear. Maybe you can talk a little bit about linear in that perspective.
Sure. Yeah, it, you know, it would be easy if it was like, okay, point A, get sober. Point B, deal with your trauma. Point C, great, you're fixed.
Right, right.
Right, but like you, when you mentioned relapse, that's what makes it nonlinear. You know, you make, sometimes you take 10 steps forward and then 2 steps back and then 8 steps forward and then 3 steps back. You know, you, if especially if you're doing trauma work, there's going to be typically, like when I'm working with clients, I tell them this is going to get a whole lot harder before it gets easier, mm-hmm. right? Like we're going to have to climb up this mountain where you're remembering things you don't want to remember. You're talking about things you don't want to talk about. You're feeling all these emotions that you've stuffed with whatever, for the last however many decades, years, whatever. Mm-hmm. And so that work is hard. And then you kind of get to the top. And then it starts getting a lot easier, right?
Right?
So even trauma work, like, you know, you feel like you've made a lot of gains and then something triggers you and like you're right back to having nightmares and being angry and like just not being able to deal with things. And then it gets better. And this the same as same with addiction, right? Like mm-hmm. you get sober, maybe you go through a honeymoon phase, you trip over your shoe and you relapse.
Right.
Right. And then you have to kind of backtrack a little bit and get back on track and then start doing the work again. So that's what I mean by nonlinear. It's not just this A, B, C. Sometimes you're like all over the place.
Right, right. Yeah, I've known people, well, and myself early in recovery, suffered a relapse or put myself into a relapse. And we work with sponsors, which are just people who have been through it and mm-hmm. can help people navigate recovery. Through that program, to a person, what they'll tell you is, okay, well, we were up to the third step. Let's start over again because we probably missed something.
Sure.
In there, so like you say, you have to back up and kind of figure out what happened there, and that's where the journaling or the charting, as you call it, comes in. And the really sad part is, a lot of people I know in my program or have known. Is they'll have a stumble like that, they'll have a relapse, and they don't make it back.
Yeah.
Because I really gave it my best shot, and now I blew it. I may as well just keep going till mm-hmm. the end. Is there any reeling people back in from that sort of event, in your experience?
I think, yeah, in most cases, you know, there's some balance because as you know, to get sober, you have to want to get sober.
Right.
Right. And when you relapse, I think that's where all that shame sets in. Like this shame, the guilt, the regret, feeling like you just can't, like you aren't capable, right? Mm-hmm. But in my experience, if somebody has gotten to a place where they're starting to believe in themselves or they've got like a support system that isn't shaming them for what happened, they're able to get back on track. I've worked with hundreds of people that relapsed one time or 20 times and just for whatever reason were able to get back on the horse.
Right. In AA, because we all know it's going to happen to some people, maybe not others. Some people out there have that burning bush moment that just flips a switch hardwired mm-hmm. and they're not going back out. But we remind people when they come back in that in AA, we don't shoot our wounded. We welcome them back in and we work with them all that much harder.
You know? You know, I've worked with a lot of people who have told me that a relapse was the best thing that happened to them.
Mm-hmm.
Because before relapsing, they'd gotten some skills, they were clear-headed, they were doing well, and they were able to really see just how fast it takes 1 second to make a bad decision and mm-hmm. to just kind of be back in that path. And I've heard a lot of people say like, that was the moment because I was already clear-headed. So I was able to like reflect and see, okay, this is how I got myself there.
Right.
This is what happened. And using that as like fuel to like get back on track and to use that to avoid relapse in the future.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I've experienced that myself. It's like, it seemed like a good idea. And then we talk about in AA that my addiction's over in the corner doing push-ups, just waiting for me to take that first drink so we can go on. Because I certainly believe that my disease has progressed forward as if I was still drinking
sure.
in my mind. So if I were to take a drink today after 28 years, I wouldn't want to just have one or two drinks and then end up at six or seven. I mean, I'd be down in a half gallon of booze in less than a week.
Right.
Yeah, because my disease would have progressed to that point.
Right.
Even though I wasn't participating consciously anyway. Yeah. So yeah, that can be really tough.
Well, and the addicted brain will do anything it can possibly do to get that substance back.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. All those receptors just waiting and wanting that dopamine. Thank goodness it works in the opposite direction, just slow, that eventually they'll die off and they won't get replaced. And you're building receptors for more healthy operations down the road. Yeah, the science of it is frightening.
Yes.
And I'm happy that science is finally catching up to what AA was preaching in the 1930s.
Sure, sure. Well, and I like this idea of not shooting the wounded. I know when I'm working with people who have relapsed, I'll tell them, like, who cares if you relapsed? It's not about what you did.
Right.
Like, it's about what you do next.
Right.
Like, we all make mistakes. We all slip up in a million different ways. Like, that doesn't even really matter. Like, now what? What do we do now? Are you going to keep doing it? Or are we going to use this to make a different decision?
Right. I had a boss who used to tell me, it's not how you screw up, it's how you recover.
That's
right.
Because
everybody screws
up. That's
right. So just recover. Recover. Hey, we're talking
recovery.
Look
at that.
And you know what? We're about recovered out of time here. The time has flown by. So I want to say thanks, Casey, for sitting in and talking about trauma and this and that. And we didn't even get into Fred. But that's okay. He probably doesn't listen to the radio. He's deaf anyway, right?
Well, no, he can hear, but it's always about him. So it's okay that today it wasn't.
And for those who don't know, Fred is Casey's English bulldog. He's quite a kick. He's an enigma unto himself. So anyway, I'm going to close it up here. Again, thanks, Casey, for sharing some thoughts. And if you think you have a problem with drugs or alcohol or behavioral health, you do. Last time I was sober, man, I felt bad. Worst hangover that I ever had. It took six hamburgers and scotch all night. Nicotine for breakfast just to put me right. Cause if you want suicide note on 100
If you wanna look cool, yes, if you wanna look cool, you got to run on heavy, heavy fuel, heavy, heavy.